Welcome back to the Great Dive Podcast, everybody. You're here with the Seeker of Death.
The Seeker.
Jim Beam Jamesy.
And old Brando. I'm just going to keep it at that. I don't.
Just old Seeker. Brando this week?
Well, yeah, why not?
I thought you'd be a little bit more excited getting into part two.
Combat
of
medic.
Shadow Divers.
After getting into Shadow Divers, and you read the bios, I guess, if you want to call them that, the descriptions of the character development of these guys, I looked at old John Chatterton, and we shared a lot of common.
You're like twinsies.
Well,
like besties.
I don't know if I'd go that far.
Doppelgangers, maybe.
I wouldn't go that far. I mean, we do share. So his first car was a Gremlin.
No, say it ain't so.
It's
did
true.
He have a Firebird on the hood?
Nobody has that. I'm one in a lifetime. That's, you know, it's not that I don't do things that other people do. It's just that when I do them, I do them differently. Okay, so that's what you got to know about me, James. And you haven't learned that over these 25 years or so of our acquaintanceship. You haven't learned that I am a Firebird on a Gremlin guy, have you? But he was also a medic, although he was an Army medic, and a little bit different times. Things are different, obviously, in Vietnam and in Japan. I was tactical flight medic, so I was the guy on the helicopter or the C-130 that flew to the front line to pick up a wounded soldier. And he was the medic. Well, he was a medic in a hospital for a long time, which medics do. We all get trained that we can work in a hospital if need be. Combat medics and tactical flight medics, especially flight medics, we go through a bunch of different training further on into the medical field. And then get into independent duty medics, which are like a medic where you get stationed in a remote location and you're the doc for like a dozen people or something. So they don't, you know, you don't need a doctor sitting up there with 12 people in a remote location.
Right.
So they send a medic because we're cheap. We're a lot cheaper.
I saw MASH when I was younger, so I pretty much know what you mean.
You know, you get it, and we all have a still in our tent. That's how it was in the desert. Actually, there was a difference between MASH and real life. We couldn't have booze at all over there. We weren't supposed to. Anyway, both medics in the military. We both went to the Divers Academy of the Eastern Seaboard for commercial diving school out there in New Jersey.
You both like shipwreck diving.
We're both cancers and enjoy long walks on the beach, reflecting on our inner journey through life.
You're both well manscaped.
Well, I was waiting for the segue. I was trying to toss a softball, I would say.
And you know what everybody wants this time of year? Because it's spring.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say they want smooth balls.
Spring cleaning, damn it. That's right. People, this episode is brought to you by the Spring Cleaning Champions. You got it. Manscaped. This season, make sure to groom your carpets and your drapes. But the leaders in below-the-waist grooming, clear out that winter bush with Manscaped. You know it. That big, furry, try to stay warm underneath the covers all winter long. Not anymore. Spring is here. Grab your little budgies. Grab your Lawnmower 5.0 and watch your confidence bloom like the springtime flowers. Just like those little tulips. Trim up your tulip, Brando. That's what I'm trying to say.
Whoa.
Embrace the season
personal.
And join the 10 million men worldwide who trust Manscaped with our special offer. You know it. Go over to manscaped.com and use the code THEGREATDIVE for 20% off and free shipping, everybody.
Do it. Your balls will thank you. You're supposed to. Isn't that the.
Your balls will have some spring fever, damn it.
Spring fever. It's in the air.
That's
and
right.
And in your pants.
You can get that fifth generation trimmer. For down there in your pants. Two interchangeable blades. How you liking that thing, Brando? That skin safe blade head. One for taking that little fluff off the top. And you got that little foil blade so you can go all smooth and silky down where
Well, you can use counts. That on your face. Two. Let's not restrict our minds to just one area.
You can with, especially with that new handyman electric shaver. That thing's awesome.
Yeah, just got that, and that looks to be a nice little addition to the Manscaped collection of tools I have in my garage / bathroom.
Well, I know it. Like your spring cleaning has been going pretty well. You're looking rather dapper and handsome.
I don't know, you got that combo
of that beard hedger pro and your handyman kind of combo, cleaning yourself up with that signature Brando look.
If you could smell me right now, you could smell my deodorant and body spray from manscaped.com. It's the total package.
You're looking like the Michigan Sean Connery.
Shaken, not stirred. Mish Money Penny.
All right, everybody, get 20% off free shipping with the code THEGREATDIVE. Don't forget, they changed it from TGDP to THEGREATDIVE at manscaped.com. That's 20% off free shipping with the code THEGREATDIVE at manscaped.com. Nothing like a little spring cleaning in your pants. Brando, it's part two, Shadow Divers.
It is.
And we said we were going to get into some of the characters of this crazy story. And last year, we had old Captain Bill Nagel, because that's where the story really started. But Shadow Divers mostly revolves around the story of John Chatterton. And then later, we'll learn about Richie Kohler. And we talked and touched about John last week a little bit, about being a commercial diver and wanting to go scuba diving and wanting to go see some shipwrecks and diving off the New Jersey shore diving and then finally getting introduced to Captain Nagel and the Seeker and getting out on that boat and really made his name out there.
Yeah, he's got an interesting story, so we should just dive into it to give a little background of how he came to be in Brielle, New Jersey. Brielle, New Jersey.
He was a beach boy.
Which one? Was he Barbara Ann?
No, but I think he might have had a little deuce coupe.
If you know what I mean.
Growing up. No, he was a beach boy. His mom took him to the beach. It's where he first fell in love. It's where he fell in love with the sea.
Okay.
You know, he lived out there on Long Island in New York. Grew up in New York, Long Island, little town of Garden City.
Garden City. There's one in every state.
And his mom would take him regularly out to the beach in the summer times.
Sure. If you're living on the coast.
Robert Kirsten says in his book, Brando, it was the salt water that gave John his feeling. At home, he was thrilled by little. School was okay. Books were so-so. Mickey Mantle was all right. But when he stood in the Atlantic up to his knees and looked out over the horizon, he felt as if he could see a different world, a world that no one talked about. At home, he would push his T-shirts against his face and smell the salt water. And that also gave John his feeling.
His feeling for the sea. Yeah, it starts as a kid, doesn't it?
Yeah. I remember being a young kid, hanging out with Grandma and Grandpa out on the lake, and having that same curiosity of, what's down there? Treasures.
Nothing but treasures. There's nothing but treasures down there. As we know from diving at the local lakes.
They're very well hidden.
They are.
But for John, it was it was something that started what would become, whether he knew it at the time or not, was going to become a lifelong quest. And he was going to go on a journey. Luckily for him, I mean, he really hit the treasure as far as, you know, something that every scuba diver, you know, that starts diving probably dreams about. I mean, how many divers get to be the focal character of deep sea diving and shipwrecks and underwater investigation and to become the host of a TV show that runs for years? I mean, it's a kind of a dream gig he fell into.
Yeah, I'll say. The dream gig is the understatement of the year because It just doesn't happen very often to most people. So in order to understand that, though, we have to understand how he came to become the diver he is, as described in Robert Kirson's novel, Shadow Divers.
You know, Kirson talks a little bit about him growing up in his teenage years in high school and kind of being torn between the whole war thing, the whole Vietnam War of, you know, do I, you know, go and fight for my country, or do I stay here and hit on the flower girls?
Flower girls, eh?
Do I stay here and, you know, try to get with the hippie chicks, or do I do something with my life, I guess, kind of like that? Where he had that epiphany in there. Then when he decided, you know, I want to go see the world. I don't want to just listen to people's stories of what's right and what's wrong and who's doing the good, who's doing the bad. And he went and he joined the army.
He didn't get drafted? I'm just asking because a lot of people were being drafted in his age. A lot of men were being drafted at his age for Vietnam because nobody wanted to go. I mean, there were a few people. It wasn't like World War II or anything where, you know, 16-year-olds were lying about their age to go defend our freedoms, allegedly.
Well, Kirson said that he really admired his grandfather.
Yeah.
Who was a Navy man.
Sure. That gave him his ideological viewpoint on bravery. You know, and his dad, although his dad was a Yale graduate, so, I mean, the Chattertons were not, I'm sure not blue-collar family. If you're a Yale graduate, I doubt you're doing a blue-collar job. As a matter of fact, we know he wasn't.
No, yeah. the city of Garden City, New York, is not in a lower lower code. Class neighborhood. It is quite the opposite.
As a matter of fact, I know, Kirson does a nice job of like letting you know, like, hey, he lived pretty good. He was one of the first kids to have, you know, a big TV and. I think Kirson says, quote, I think he says, his training wheels didn't squeak on his bike like all the other kids, you know.
So, right. Yeah. Them's some nice training wheels to grow up with.
So anyway, John, what I'm getting at is, John wasn't like living a struggling life. And he did go into the army. And a lot of that was, as pointed out in the book by Kirson, that influence came from his grandfather, who was a Navy man, and his whole idea. I think Kirson, I mean, if you read the character, Kirson does get a lot into, John's admiration of the characteristic of bravery or courage in an individual. So he admires that quality and attempts to, you know, be loyal to himself in the sense of staying brave and knowing you have to answer.
Yeah, because when he first went over into the army as a medic, he was working in a pretty posh hospital in Japan.
Right, he was a hospital medic, meaning he was helping out with the docs and nurses, taking care of the wounded, but not in a forward location. He was actually in a hard building and did his 40-hour a week job.
Right. And Kirson says in the book, he says, if a soldier had it good in 1970, that soldier was Chatterton. He rode trains and drank beer and dined often in Osaka's Suiyaki houses. He liked his work. It was emotional and important. He was seeing the world. He was out of harm's way. But as he watched the parade of ruined lives delivered to the neuro ward, he began to ask questions that would not go away. What caused people to do this to one another? How is this happening to these guys? What is going on over that hill? And from there, Kirson goes into really talking about John moving from that hospital out into the field of being a medic.
Yeah. Well, he was a medic in the hospital, and they can call you to be a to be a forward medic, depending on your location and your boss. But if you've got the training, they can put you up there. I mean, especially if it's a last resort kind of thing. I know combat medics today are a little bit different. Maybe they learned a little bit from Vietnam. The training is a little more extensive. I know the training back then was like 6 months. I know my training was a lot more. I had 2 years of school before they release you to start working on actual people.
Sure,
you do it in your training, but 6 months is all he had. Yeah. Yeah, because the book does go into the conversation. By the time John was going into the Army, his parents were divorced. The book insinuates that his dad had a drinking problem, but his dad had just made a major deal developing. You know, he had started his own company, and they developed that Bar-O-Matic. You know, the Bar-O-Matic is the thing that pours your drinks from one central sprayer.
Oh, right.
So that's John Chatterton's dad who's responsible for that. Well,
whenever you go to any restaurant in the world.
Remember that, yeah. You see the Bar-O-Matic in action.
Yes.
So, yeah, anyway.
But, yeah, he had...
It does say here... Like, John first wanted to go in the Navy because of his grandfather. And then he writes, but the Navy made provisions for the grandchildren of heroes. And John wanted no special treatment. The Army promised to make a volunteer a medic in return for a 4-year commitment. So that's what he signed up for with the Army, because he didn't want special treatment from the Navy.
And his dad wanted him to not go into the military at all.
Right.
His dad wanted him to, hey, you know, we come from a good family. We don't have to be military kids. You know, come out, you know, here with me, work with me, have a good business life. But John wanted something different. And he got it. His dad ended up dying pretty soon thereafter, too. Rather young. His dad died at 48 years old.
Yeah. That is a little young, isn't it?
Yeah, no kidding.
Just shows you. Borrowed time. I'm on borrowed time.
life was hard back in the 70s.
He was a Yale graduate. He was hold on. Life was hard back in the 70s.
Well, he was hard on himself. I mean, according to Kirsten, he smoked 4 packs of cigarettes a day.
So that had nothing to do with the 70s.
Well,
disco. Disco was just emerging. Come on, maybe that killed him.
He had those life questions: to bell bottom or not to bell bottom?
Exactly.
It was a different world,
and yet it was the same.
But coming back out of Vietnam, you know, he came back to New York and. The sea was once again calling the man. Became a scallop fisherman.
Yeah.
Did that for a while. You know, got married. Didn't. He was looking for himself. What do I do? Like, wasn't in love with him. When the scallops were scalloping, things were good.
It was good, yeah.
But when they weren't, it wasn't. It was a tough life.
Yeah, you got paid by the load you guys picked up out there. And, when scallops were scalloping, he was digging it. But I mean, are we gonna cover some of his stuff as a medic?
You know, Brandon, Robert Kirsten, I mean, if you can do a complete biography of somebody, you know, in 30 pages, you know, and do it accurately, that's a difficult task to take on. But there's a full chapter dedicated just to the life of John Chatterton. And there's a full chapter that Kirsten does on the life of Richie Kohler. We'll get to that, too.
Yeah.
I guess my point is it's hard to tell a complete story in roughly 30-some pages.
Oh, yeah.
Right, because there's a lot of life. And a lot of his book or a lot of that chapter is spent talking about his time in Vietnam.
Yeah, I think it'd be difficult to paint anyone's, you know, no matter how quote-unquote mundane of life you believe you may have lived, I still think it would be difficult to paint an accurate, you know, detailed picture of who you were. And I think the whole point of Kersen, what he does with Chatterton, Kohler, Nagel, who are like the main characters in the story, is for character development. So you can kind of start to identify with these folks, right? And suck you into the story. That's the point of it. So he
absolutely
does,
yeah,
right. So he
and
does.
That's why he spends a lot of time talking about how he's so committed to excellence.
Exactly.
And bravery means
bravery.
So much.
Yes. Yes, he does. He does a little. I mean, with both Chatterton, Kohler, and Nagel, all three of these, he does try to weave that common thread of this underlying core value of respect for something like bravery. Like, I mean, from his time as a medic, where he talks in the book about how John wanted to get out of his cozy little cushy hospital assignment in Japan, where he was partying and, you know, just doing a regular 40-hour week job in a foreign country, which there's a lot in the military. I mean, you can do that. He wanted to be on the front lines. He wanted to test himself. This is how Kersen writes this, and so he volunteers to go to Vietnam into the big show there and see what he's made of. And then we get a couple of little stories of how he showed himself who he was based on these core values of bravery and doing the right thing. And you don't want to look back and say, I chicken shit it out and I'm not the person I think I am.
Kersen says that once a friend who had promised to help Chatterton rake leaves at 9 a.m., arrived instead at noon. Chatterton.
I think I have that same friend.
Chatterton walked away from the man and told him,
fuck you.
Chatterton walked
You're
away from
dead
the man,
to me.
Then did not speak to him for a month.
A whole month?
A whole month. He's not reliable.
Well,
I can't be living like that. Reliability is everything, he told his wife.
Everything
at the time.
Because of the leaf raking. We didn't get the other side of that story, though. It might have been, you know. They didn't have cell phones, so kids listening, it wasn't like you just picked, you know, you just grabbed your phone out of your pocket and called your buddy and said, hey, I'm going to be late or whatnot, or there's extenuating circumstances.
Right.
Okay, so there was none of that. Like here today in our world, you have no real excuses barring you are incapacitated for being late and not warning your buddy. But we don't know the whole story of that.
Well, exactly. That. I mean, yeah. Today, like, you know exactly how many minutes it's going to take you to arrive somewhere.
Right.
It's not a question mark like it always was in the past.
Right. So now you're really held to that. You can't be like, hey, I'm in the hospital. You know, or you just not call.
Right. I'll be there in 10 minutes.
No, you won't.
You just stepped out of the shower.
Exactly. Well, that was, I feel like you're aiming that at me. Like, my wife says everything is 20 minutes, 20 minutes away. We'll be there in 20 minutes. This job only takes 20 minutes.
Because reliability is everything.
And I am, Ari, like you cannot do it. I've been lying to myself and think I could do this any longer. Yeah, so, I mean, it's that kind of stuff. So these little stories, these little subtle events in his life that kind of paint a picture of who John Chatterton was. Like I say, the medic stuff is a good tool for the author because as a medic in a war zone, you're going to find out who you are, what you're made of. Real quick.
Ed Kersen says in here, for 4 months, Chatterton thought about the right way and the wrong way to live, and he continued to contemplate his principles.
For just 4 months? I got it figured out in 4 months. Anyway, it does make you, I mean, that was one of the reasons I went into the military, to figure out who I am, and that is what you will do in the service, if you want to. I mean, you can always ignore things. Service does make it hard at times in certain jobs and certain situations you'll find yourself in.
Well, Kirsten says, as weeks turned to months and Chatterton continued to distinguish himself, he studied himself and others in action, watched soldiers live and die, and show courage and break down, paid careful attention to the behavior of men around him, all to divine further insight into the right way to live.
Exactly. I mean, this is so Kirsten's really painting, especially with the whole medic thing, because he decided to volunteer as a medic for a 4-year stint in the army. They would give him the job as a medic because it wouldn't go against his values of not killing people that he was struggling with. So he was still identifying with the protesters against the war, but he also identified with like his grandfather, who was a patriotic naval hero.
That's what I meant by bringing up the hippie chicker. He says being in Vietnam brought him to believe in these things. He makes a big deal about it in the book.
Yeah.
If an undertaking was easy, someone else already would have done it.
Yeah.
If you follow in another's footsteps, you miss the problems really worth solving. Excellence is born of preparation, dedication, focus, and tenacity. Compromise on any of these, and you become average.
And yeah, I mean, that's the idea we're getting through the character development through the chapter on John and
right.
throughout the book. Like, he is a man of high value in the sense of he wants to know who he is, and then those traits, he doesn't compromise on those ideals.
Every so often, life presents a great moment of decision.
It does.
An intersection at which a man must decide to stop or go. A person lives with these decisions forever.
That's right. That is right. So this is a key moment because
examine everything. Not all is as it seems or as people tell you.
Well, that is the goddamn truth.
It is easiest to live with a decision if it is based on an earnest sense of right and wrong.
And I think you're getting to the nitty-gritty of John Chatterton.
The guy who gets killed is often the guy who got nervous. The guy who doesn't care anymore. Who has said, I'm already dead. The fact that I live or die is irrelevant. And the only thing that matters is the accounting I give of myself. Is the most formidable force in the world.
One of them. I haven't seen my angry wife.
And lastly, Brando, he says...
When I made decisions like based on that.
And lastly, the worst possible decision is to give up.
Okay.
So these are the foundational beliefs that like Kirsten paints that John Chatterton lives by. And like you just said a minute ago, throughout the book and throughout the hunt for the discovery of this you-who and why he puts so much passion into it and lets his whole world, you know, fall down around him as far as, you know, life and family and friends. And like it's the tenacity of this discovery is what means everything to him.
Well, yeah. I mean, this is what was going through his head in Japan, actually, too, because as Kirsten writes, he looks at the soldiers coming back from the war, and he says in the book, Kirsten writes, to Chatterton, these soldiers were not, quote, charge of the light brigade, unquote, types. They looked stunned, afraid, lonely, but they also looked like they knew something Chatterton did not know. So as the months pass and all the neurological patients poured through the doors from the war, it says Chatterton's questions grew more urgent. So he began questioning himself even more. He started telling friends that he might request a transfer to Vietnam. So he's mulling all this over, and based on what he's seeing, what he's been told, you know, his idea of war and soldiers and honor and valor and courage and all this. He's not seeing that in the faces of the soldiers coming back. And it doesn't add up. So he goes and he starts telling his buddies and his people he works with, he's thinking about requesting a transfer to Vietnam. And they all tell him, you're fucking nuts. And the patients he's treating are like, don't do it. You're crazy. Do not go there. It's the dumbest thing in the world. Do your time. Go home. Go home in one piece. That's what they would tell him. But in the book, it says Chatterton, he kind of listened to all this, and then he says, but Chatterton requested the transfer. In June 1970, he was on an airplane to Chu Lai in South Vietnam. So right there, Kirsten says he seeing all he was seeing was not jiving with his idea of courage and bravery, what a soldier should be. So he had to go see for himself, see what he's made of.
And then throughout the book, when he starts diving with Nagel.
Yeah.
And diving on the Doria and doing the dives on the Yoo-Hoo, it's these attributes that he learned in this life is what he's going to show is what, you know, kept him fighting, kept him working, kept him discovering, got to know more about this shipwreck. This is where it was all built.
I think that's a good example of how these decisions you make shape who you are, you know what I mean? So, and that's, the military is definitely good for that. That's why a whole, you know, umpteen pages devoted to John's brief time in the service that obviously was very impactful on developing the man that he became.
Kirsten says, in the early months of 1988, Chatterton began training for a return trip to the Doria and asking himself why he was so drawn to shipwrecks. As the Doria trip drew closer, he believed he understood. A shipwreck was a vast repository of secrets. Some of these secrets could be uncovered through exploration. They came up in the form of artifacts. Other secrets inside the shipwreck were less tangible. Those were secrets about the diver himself. A shipwreck gave a man limitless opportunity to know himself, if only he cared to find out. He could always press further, dig deeper, find places no one had mastered. To Chatterton, there always seemed to be opportunity on a shipwreck, even the simple shipwrecks. The opportunity to confront the problems really worth solving, and this meant everything to him. This was the fact that made his life feel worthwhile. He started to tell colleagues that wreck diving had a lot to do with finding out about yourself.
And I think we've said diving, period, has a lot to do with finding out about yourself, no matter, you know, what type of diving you're doing. I think we've said that.
I think Brandon Schwartz has said that numerous times on the Great Dive Podcast.
Especially at the pub after the dive.
No, but like you couldn't have, like where I was going with this, like you couldn't have said that learning about yourself.
Yeah.
Well, perfect, because okay, I wanted to hit that. That's where I hit that next one.
It's easy to see by Kirsten's description of his time at Vietnam and how John used that time to reflect on who he was and watch others. And, you know, when you see that kind of stuff happen on a daily basis, life and death happen, and you start to instill this characteristic that comes out through the rest of your life. Like even when you look at John's actions in Shadow Divers, as well as the Last Dive with the Rouses, when they had their incident on the Yoo-Hoo.
Well, it's very much written just like another scene from Vietnam of him like running through the jungles, you know, dodging bullets, you know, him jumping into the water to carry, you know, divers back onto a boat. It's foreshadowed many times throughout the book.
He throws him, you know, they cut him out of his gear and he throws him on his shoulder and climbing up a violently rocking boat with a body over your shoulder. That's some hardcore stuff.
When you read Shadow Divers, it goes much more into detail in some ways about the dives that Chris and Chrissy Rouse did.
Yeah.
in so much as in the last dive, it's so hyper-focused on that dive. You would think that they got on a boat that morning, drove out to the dive site, and that was the dive. But in reality, they had been doing a couple of dives already.
Oh, they had done, yeah. They had done other dives, yeah.
They'd been on it the day before.
Right.
Chrissy had already been down working in that area that he was going to, ultimately perishing.
Right. Right, yeah. I mean, the story's a little more complex in the sense that we get a few more details of the events leading up to the incident of Chris and Chrissy Rouse having to surface and skip their decompression after an hour-ish. Was it an hour or 40 minutes? I can't remember. Down there at 230 feet. So that's a significant obligation you've incurred, and you've toasted it. So,
as Chris and Chrissy were gearing up to do their dive, Steve McDougal was already in. Tom right. Packer, Steve Gatto had already gotten in and dived.
Yeah. Yeah, because they knew the seas were getting angry, my friend. The seas were getting angry. They knew that, and they wanted to try to get a dive in before they had to lift anchor and head out.
One of the biggest controversies about shadow divers / the last dive is the whole story about how the events transpired on the back of the Seeker when Chris and Chrissy hit the surface.
Yeah, and I think you're hinting at the large discrepancy between the two stories, which is what did Chatterton say to the Coast Guard rescue swimmer with regard to taking Chris Rouse along with Chrissy via the rescue copter back to the hospital? What did he say? Because they're opposite, really. They're
almost completely opposite. Remember, right. we did the story talking about Chowdhury's book. When Chowdhury described it, right, Chatterton was yelling at the medic, at right. the rescue swimmer, of you have to.
Yeah.
You have to take his dad. If that kid sees that he's on that chopper alone, it's going to kill him knowing that he let his dad die. You have to, even though he's dead, you have to put that body on that chopper. And the rescue swimmer said, there's no goddamn way we're taking a dead body up there. It's too dangerous.
Well, yeah.
But in shadow divers, it's a completely different story.
Yeah. I mean, they're the opposite. Of course, you got the rescue swimmer in the last dive saying, it's too dangerous. The conditions are too insane. We're taking too much risk for a dead body. And in the Shadow Divers book, he's saying the opposite, that Chatterton was wanting him to leave without Chris.
In Shadow Divers, Kirsten says basically that this is like another day in the park for this helicopter. That's a big deal. Come on. It's drop the basket, pull it up. We do this 1,000 times a day. This is just basic day at work.
Right. And Chatterton was the one saying no. So it is a glaring difference.
In Shadow Divers, it says that Chatterton was yelling the opposite to the medic.
Exactly.
Just go. Dad's dead. There's no point of you wasting time. And the medic is saying, no, we're getting everybody. We're doing our job. That's what we're here to do.
Exactly. So
same characters.
Exactly.
Same boat, same situation,
but
two completely different stories.
Right. And then when you look at the sources for both books, you're trying to figure out how did they come up with something so important. I think it is an important aspect to the story. I know what came out of it is that both were evac'd, but this is an important little detail. Like if you were in a court of law with a lawyer, and you had these two glaring differences, there'd be like, okay, somebody is not telling the truth. Okay, it's not a I saw it this way, you saw it that way. There are numerous witnesses. There's a half dozen people or more on this boat, that can tell you what happened. There's
right.
The
it's not like I was at the park on the same day.
Exactly.
And kind of way over on the other end of the park, something was happening, and I saw a guy running, so I assumed.
Right.
You know, no, I mean, this is, you know, a bunch of people on the same boat in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean.
So your sources are the exact same. Your sources are the exact same.
With almost the exact same perspective. I mean, sure, you might have been standing on the port side of the boat and I on the starboard side.
But right? You were there, yeah.
You might have been in the, you know, in the galley, you know, doing something here and there. But, I mean, it's fucking chaos on this boat. There's nobody on the boat that doesn't know what's happening.
Right. Oh, yeah. I mean, and you've got ex-military on there. You've got Barb Lander, who's a nurse, who's, you know, the highest medically qualified person on the boat who can do almost anything. You've got the state cop and McDougal. You've got you've got some customers who are used to a little bit of chaos, so they can make their way through it. But in the book, it was Chatterton calling the shots. But that with that glaring difference that take Chris, you have to take Chris. You have to take Chrissy's father in the last dive. And then in Shadow Divers, you have to leave now to save Chrissy. Don't worry about his father. Don't take him.
Polar opposites.
So that's I mean, that's a on the internet. It was on the internet. Somebody pointed out that difference. And I think we should address some of the differences between Shadow Divers and The Last Dive, and other people's account of the whole Yoo-hoo search and other things involved with these East Coast wreckers. Doesn't take away that the book's a good story.
Well, let's be very clear, in my opinion. Robert Curson didn't just want to write a book about a submarine.
Well, Robert Curson
He wanted to write a bestseller.
Yeah, Robert Curson isn't... Bernie Chowdery. Robert Curson is a professional writer by trade. He's written for the big screen. He's a writer, and that's how he makes his living. So he's involved with that area between novels and the big screen, the silver screen.
He's telling a beautiful story.
He's telling a story.
Over the course of 400 pages, it's going to be a beautiful, beautiful story. And it is. From when John finds Hornburg's knife on the sub. one of the early discoveries. But it's interesting how that takes them on a whole different route of what this submarine could be, right? Because really, they discover the Yoo-hoo right from the very beginning, but because history is written incorrectly, they're on a wild goose chase for years before they get the confirmation of, no, that we were actually right all along.
Yeah, according to Curson and according to what he says. And I mean, you got to point out, too, that, yes, Curson's an author. He's the silver screen guy who gets his books made into movies kind of thing. But the book is touted, it's right there on the inside cover, it's the true adventure of two Americans who risked everything to solve one of the last mysteries of World War II. I think they're forgetting about Bill Nagel. I'm guessing he means only Kohler and Chatterton. But there's other people involved. And then, like I say, the true, when you put the word true in it, you can't just... You don't like, I don't know if that was why it was changed. If you don't like something, you just change it. You can't do that. It's called the truth. Don't give me my truth and your truth and all our truths. There is the truth.
Well, Newsweek said that this book was absorbing a fantastic yarn that happens to be true.
Oh, yeah. Well, at least portions of it. It is a good story. It's a good story. If you're into diving, you're into shipwrecks, if you're into high human virtues like bravery and doing the right thing and all that, the story has a lot of that in it. So they have to identify this wreck, and Chatterton figures out one of the places that will have an identifying engraved tag is in the spare parts box in the engine room. So there's a spare parts box on these submarines, he learns, and inside of that spare part box will have an engraved tag of the submarine's number, right? You whatever the fuck, you something, the you who. Anyway, so he has an idea to get to the engine room. He's got this, he comes up with a plan, right? And everybody thinks the plan is nuts.
Curson says Chatterton's final plan for the Yoo-hoo was audacious and lethal.
Who's
he would swim into the dieseled motor room with just a single tank on his back, not the customary two. He would then remove that tank and hold it in front of him, much as a child holds a kickboard when learning to swim, and push it through the narrow opening between the fallen fuel tank and the U-boat ceiling. Once on the other side of the diesel motor room, he would reattach the tank to his back and swim into the adjoining electric motor room, where he hoped to find identifying tags attached to boxes of spare parts.
So this audacious plan, I mean, Chatterton was like, this is vision, as he put it. This can work, he says. But Kohler, this is lunacy. You know, this is nuts. This is crazy.
Well, so, think about it. 230 feet on inside of a shipwreck on a single tank?
It's crazy. It is crazy, because how long do you really have, and you're inside of the wreck by yourself with a single tank? And so Kohler is thinking along these lines, and he grabs a notebook and pen, and he starts scribbling out, according to Curson, a list of the things that could go wrong. Mostly like John runs out of gas and drowns. The list reads like this. So.
Well, it's what he basically exactly. says. Is like, that's how every one of these marks on this list ends. Is exactly. John dies. John dies.
We it's like that this. Movie. John dies in the end. Yeah. So he talks about, you know, Chatterton could become entangled in the many wires, pipes, the fittings, the cables, everything hanging down. It's a disaster inside of a shipwreck like that.
Wait,
you know?
You mean it's a wreck?
It's a shipwreck.
It's
yeah.
not a perfectly built floating ship that's making it easy to get in and out of. It's a shipwreck. Yeah, like,
of course,
dangerous. And John dies in the end.
Yeah. I mean, but we already knew that. But this is a new list, right? So this is like, he could be pinned under falling objects, just like old Chrissy Rouse.
Just like Chrissy Rouse. He's going back there where you can't fit in normal gear. So he's going to go with a single tank and be in a even more difficult of an area to be in. Easily could get pinned. And then John yeah. dies in the end.
Exactly. And you've got less gas. I mean, so he could be pinned under falling debris. A piece of machinery could fall on him. There's numerous pieces of machinery. It's a goddamn U-boat. He has one single gas supply. So you're relying on a single gas supply. You eliminate your redundancy of twins, which is, you know, a second complete source of gas for you. So just an O-ring fails, you could lose your gas.
Right.
The rake starts free flowing.
You cut a hose by jagged, torn up piece of metal trying to slip through an area. You have nothing. You have no backup to rely on.
Yeah. And these are, I mean, the reasons we're talking about.
And then John dies.
And then John dies. I mean, the reasons we're talking about are the main reasons you use twins in an overhead, and you don't use a single tank. You don't take off your gear, grab a single tank, and push it through the wreck with you. So he's going to use his gas faster because he's going to be working more, is what he says. He says, again, he goes back into the room's going to be filled with cables and wires and machinery, and that he's going to have a tough time with the room's layout. Like, he normally is able to see the room's layout, apparently.
But this time, we're not going to progressively penetrate. He's going to make a major push all the way to the back.
Right. But, I mean, by the same token, it's one way in, one way out. It's not like, okay, you got an offshoot over here. I'm going to take it over to the promenade deck, and we're going to go into the kitchen or whatever. So none of that's going to happen. There's no way out the other end of the electric motor room. As its aft end has been crushed downward, is what he says in the book. So
he has to come back.
The same way he went in.
The same way.
Right.
Which means, you know, back to those other previous points, if something falls, he's fucked.
He's kind of fucked. Nobody's going to come in the other way. You're going to have to go in, and somebody else is going to have to take off their equipment to get through and push another single tank through. I mean, the number of possibilities of this thing going south just keeps getting bigger and bigger. So the water inside the electric motor room, Richie says, so it's been undisturbed by divers, by anything. So it's going to be all full of silt and, you know, just so easily the visibility could be destroyed.
Yeah, you're going to be swimming in just absolute black nothingness of visibility.
Right. Just like in cave
light,
diving.
Light absorbing blackness.
Exactly. Light occluding and absorbing, yes. And then even something like the bubbles from your exhaust is going to disturb the rust, disturb who knows what, and maybe dislodge things, maybe destroy the visibility even worse. So these are just a list of this is where John died. John runs out of gas and drowns.
And then John dies in the end.
Exactly. So his bubbles, as we've known, James, you remember we were diving, I believe it was the Straits, and we were inside, was it the Cedarville?
Cedarville, yeah.
Yeah, and our bubbles disturbed some of the oil in the aft section of that shipwreck. The stern section, I should say, whatever. But it disturbed some of the oil, and as we were coming up the deco line, little mushroom clouds of oil that looked like little brown wafers floating up next to us.
Globules of oil.
Exactly, exactly. So that you can disturb all of that with your bubbles, and that would blind them even more, you know. If that
smudge of oil got onto the glass of your mask.
Yeah.
And now I can't see through that as well as all this other stuff.
It's just another thing.
Another thing where John dies in the end.
Yes, John dies in the end.
Yeah.
Runs out of gas and dies.
Kohler said, any one of these can kill you, but you'll be lucky if only one of them happens.
Well, I think that's a pretty accurate statement as far as I doubt just one of these things are going to happen alone. You're going to have a couple of them.
But, Brando, I mean, if we go back to early in the book when Kersen was talking about the beliefs that Chatterton grew to have, right? If an undertaking was easy, Brando. I mean, Richie, someone else would have already done it, Richie. If you follow in somebody else's footsteps, you miss the problem that's really worth solving, right? I mean, all these things that we said earlier, like, that was the foreshadowing of, like, this dive's got to get done. And
God he's got to do it his way.
Excellence is born of preparation, dedication, focus, and tenacity.
Damn. You got me charged up. I'm ready to go now. It's like he's Frank Sinatra singing, I did it my way.
The worst possible decision, Richie, is to give up.
Yeah, God damn it. You quitter.
Oh, man.
This is the only way we can do this. This is the only way we can do this. So I hope we're painting the picture correctly. It's like we've been diving this fucking wreck. It's taken a couple of folks away from us. It's killed a couple of folks. Very dangerous, low visibility shipwreck. We need to find out this mystery, and there's only one way to do it. There's one way in there. There's one way out. We got to get to that engine.
And I'm going for it.
And I'm going to take off my gear and grab a single tank at 230 feet, and I'm going to go in there and grab that toolbox.
Man, it's a parts box. It's an amazing story.
It's crazy. It's crazy.
Balls of steel.
Now, we knew some crazy people. I mean, one guy comes to my mind who did stuff like this in the Great Lakes on a routine basis, I believe. And he was crazy. He's a little crazy. He still is crazy.
Well, I think that's a lot of what Kirsten writes in this book. I mean, he tells he weaves a yarn, an irresistible sea yarn, as Time Magazine quoted on the back cover of the book, about you know creating these two characters and the determination to do these dives. I mean, it is an edge of your seat thriller when you read through the dives that these guys are doing.
Well, you have to have it painted as if these guys really didn't have a choice in doing these dives. You can't take the reality of, okay, we don't have to do the dive. Okay, there's nothing that is like got my arm twisted. And you're going to do 230. You're destroying the narrative here.
They're not going to turn this book into a movie if they get that option on the table.
So you have to have this character development that says, okay, these men that are after this, the name of this U-boat, it's not just a quest for the name of a U-boat. It defines who they are as men and humans on the planet. It defines every true quality that they revered in life. Honor, courage, loyalty, bravery,
absolutely.
Got to get the job done because for history's sake, we have to know why was this U-boat in
I lost
waters.
My marriage because of this shipwreck.
Oh, they lost marriages.
I lost some of my best friends have passed because of this shipwreck.
Oh, yeah. I mean, lives were being crushed, literally being destroyed.
Literally,
And figuratively, too. So you have to have this driving force of this shipwreck calling you, forcing you at all costs to identify it. And the only way to do that is to get down in her, crawl around for a while with a single tank, and get back home.
There you go, people. That's a little bit about character number two of Shadow Divers, John Chatterton. And Great Dive Podcast, Shadow Divers Part 2. I hope you guys enjoyed that one. I mean, this book's awesome. We're having a lot of fun with this. There's still a lot to go over, though. We got a lot happening, a lot of people to learn about yet.
Well, we have one other main character, right?
Yeah, stay tuned next week. Yeah, because next week we got to get into Richie's part of this. It's a whole nother part of this whole book.
I wonder what he could be like. Oh, Richie. So Bill and John, they come to know each other. They share many of the same qualities as far as why they dive shipwrecks and courage, you know, that kind of thing. So I'm curious.
And we'll get to Richie
right
next week.
Until then. Should we exit?
Let's pull off our exit here.
Okay, I was just going to say, until then, don't you go change it. You can't say nothing after that.
I can't.
All right.
The Great Dive Podcast is hosted by your buddies, James and Brando.